فقلت استغفروا ربكم إنه كان غفارا
فقلت استغفروا ربكم إنه كان غفارا
يرسل السماء عليكم مدرارا
يرسل السماء عليكم مدرارا
صدق الله العلي العظيم
صدق الله العلي العظيم.
And that will mark the end of this episode. We recited Surah Nuh from verse number 6 to verse number 11. And we will conclude this episode with the recitation of Salawat on Muhammad and his pure progeny.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
Let's recite the Quran, a joint production of IRIB English Radio and Xavier International Schools.
ذكر وموعظة ونور فيه شفاء للصدور وشفيعنا يوم النشور آياته تروي المدى وصفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان والقرآن.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Iran Radio presents some interesting facts about Islam. There are an estimated 1.8 billion Muslims in the world, which is about 1.5 of the world's population. Due to the birth and conversion rates, Islam is considered to be the fastest-growing religion in the world today. Peace and greetings from Tehran. You're listening to Iran Radio. And today's programming is more than just the schedule. Of course, it's an invitation to reflect, to learn, and to feel connected. Let's begin. First, it's a new segment of radio productions. Then we tuned into A to Z of life. Next, it's time for Israel Watch to round out the hour. Keep it locked in. We've got more for you.
But do you know in America who carries the pain of Agent Orange? The veterans who serve. The veterans feel responsible.
Yes.
Our fathers felt responsible
for us.
Even for in Vietnam, I mean, they felt responsible. The soldier, not the chemical companies or the government that made the decisions.
So my father felt extreme guilt. He felt like he had caused my birth defects. He had told my mother that every time he looked at me, he felt that it was his responsibility. He had caused this to me. And that's a major problem in the United States, trying to work through the Agent Orange issue, is that the veterans feel extreme guilt.
The man that my mom knew from the time she was four did not come home from Vietnam. He's still wandering around in the jungle somewhere. He came home a very angry man, very sad man.
My dad was suffering more and more from his PTSD. He was having other health issues and he was getting weak and he couldn't do the things that he could do before, and his health was just going downhill.
My father lost his arm before he chose to have children. He lost his arm during the war. And then it took him 7 years to cope with that and feel that maybe he was mentally able to help raise a child.
The things that he had seen, he would always have flashbacks, and he suffered from PTSD really bad from all the things that he did and saw while he was in the war. And he was very abusive, and he was very violent, and he would black out at times and think that he was still in the war. And there was times like we would get up in the middle of the night, me and my brother, and we would try to get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, and he would be like hiding under our beds and grab our feet and pull us under the beds. And I mean, he had PTSD really bad.
He suffered flashbacks, lots of flashbacks. Many nights he'd wake up moaning and groaning, screaming and yelling in his sleep.
They would put him in the helicopters and stuff, and they would fly him all over and drop him off in the jungle, and they would get out of the helicopters, and the helicopters would leave him out there, and there would only be like maybe 30 guys. They were hiding everywhere, and you couldn't really run through the jungle because everything was booby-trapped, and there was pits with the spikes in them and landmines everywhere and trip wires, and they had these big logs that had a bunch of bamboo spikes on them, and they'd put them up in the trees, so when you'd walk by and you'd trip a stick or whatever, it would fall down out of the tree and impale people. And there was, he said there was times that while they were on the battlefield that he would have to go, and like his friend would be walking right in front of him, and he would step on a landmine and pieces of his friend would fly all over him, and he would have to pick up the pieces and put them in his backpack and carry them out.
He spent a lot of time by himself, very quiet. We were raised with war decor in our home, lots of Vietnam memorabilia. Pictures and videos and books and that sort of thing. So it was always around us, and we always knew what had happened to our father. We never knew him any other way, so we always knew what had happened to him.
He just couldn't take it anymore. He tried to drink the pain away. He tried to work it away. He tried to tell me and my brother everything that he went through. He tried talking about it. He tried everything. When he first got there and everything, he was just out of high school, and what he encountered when he got over there was not what he expected at all. One of the missions that he had got sent on when he first got here was that they went into a village, and the whole time I've been here, I've been trying to ask people and everything. And the other day, we were at another VAVA office, and we were there with the general. And when he started to open the book, it was mentioned that my father was in Chu Lai. Everybody that was in there said, "Oh, Chu Lai." And it kind of made me start to think, well, what went on in Chu Lai that was so bad that everybody knows about it? And he was explaining all that. But then when he found Chu Lai on the map, he pointed at it, and he cried and shut the book and pushed it away from him. And that really hit home, because that's where my dad was at. And then when we got to the museum and I found where his company and everything was at, and I saw it on the wall, and then I saw where they slaughtered all the women and children. And my dad was only 19 years old when he joined the military, when he came to Vietnam. So at 19 years old, that's what they told him to do. And they made him kill women and children. And there was like 500 of them. It wasn't like just one or two or three. It was 500 women and children. And like 70-something of those women were pregnant. So they killed the babies too. And that was the first week that my dad was here. And then he still had 13 more months to go after he had to do that. And he had to go through, I don't even know how many villages they dropped him off at, that they had to do the same thing, because that's when, during the war, it turned into basically a genocide, and everything that was out there, they killed it. Men, women, children, babies, dogs, cats, pigs, everything. They just went out there and they killed everything. Everything that they came in contact with.
My father felt pride in the sense that he followed directions, that he did what he was supposed to do. However, he harbored a lot of guilt for many, many years about the things that had happened here during his time, and the things that he was told to do, the things that he had to do in order to survive. He had terrible nightmares.
This temple represents the names of the people who died in this area during the war. On these slabs here, it talks about all the names of those who died, some without record of their birth date, but just their date of their passing. You can find very young people's names here, and very old people, men and women, babies, you know, just very young to very old.
The other part of that story is that the Vietnam veterans in general were shunned by, you know, World War II veterans and Korean War veterans and things. They were not accepted when they came home by the very people they wanted to emulate. American Legions and stuff, because they didn't win the war, they weren't real soldiers, and they didn't have a place there with the real military heroes. You're from Vietnam, and they smoke and they, you know, do drugs and they kill people, so they're bad.
I know of twice that he had tried to kill himself, and the second time that it happened, it was Christmas, and he was having a really tough time. Christmas was very difficult for him. All of his family was already gone, and then just with the PTSD, he had taken a gun and had loaded it, and thankfully had put the wrong bullet in the gun. And so when he put the gun to his head and he fired it, it misfired and it didn't go off. But we knew about that story, and that was always something that we had feared, that he would take his own life.
I got a ride from my dad, and I went back to the state of California. It was Father's Day of 1997. I was coming home, and when I got to the house, I noticed there was a bunch of police cars outside of my house, and I thought maybe somebody had hurt somebody in my family, or maybe I was in trouble or something. I didn't know, so I hurried up, and I pulled in the driveway, and I asked them what was going on, and they said that they needed to talk to me. So I went to the side with them, and I started to talk to them, and they told me that there were some people that were riding some motorcycles, and they had found my dad's body out in the middle of the desert in his car, and that he had committed suicide. And it was so hard for me because all my life my dad was always there. He always tried to help me. He helped take care of me. He helped make sure that I had my prosthetic legs and everything. And just all of a sudden, all at once, all of that was gone.
This war in Vietnam, guess what? It wasn't going like the other wars that the United States had been involved in. They think the idea that, you know, maybe America didn't win like they thought they were going to, or that there was subversive reasons for us getting into the conflict or the war itself, that America mismanaged their military, or they were after natural resources, or they just wanted land close to China. There is so much controversy just around those parameters.
The people actually got to see the war on TV. It was broadcast. They showed all the people that were getting blown up and all the kids that were getting sprayed and all the death and destruction of what the war was actually had going on in it. And once the American people saw how awful war really is, because most of the time in America, because nobody attacks America on their own soil or anything like that.
General, how would you assess yesterday's activities and today's? What is the enemy doing? Are these major attacks or...
This is the main Vietnamese language radio station in Saigon.
When the American people saw this, they started having riots in the street. They started protesting at the government. They started, like, just having all kinds of problems in the United States over it.
So many years after 1975 that it's still in infancy. Like, I don't think historians even know what to write about it. I don't think they know what's real. I don't think they know what's false about it, what's mythological about it, anything. I think at first it came out of the veteran's mouth, my kids are sick, I'm sick, and they said, guess what? You're just a bunch of baby killers. You're just a bunch of whiners. You're a bunch of drug addicts. Now you just want a free handout? That's what they were met with.
Agent Orange was a safe product when it was used in the Vietnam War, and it's a safe product today.
We don't mean to say that there isn't an Agent Orange effect, but at this point in time, we don't seem to see anything that confirms that there's something there specifically.
Just hours before, thousands of Vietnam veterans were supposed to be represented in court against seven chemical companies, there was an out-of-court settlement.
Many of my brothers have died when you sat up there and played political.
Gentlemen, we can't wait 20, 30, 40 years.
I think they just try to sweep it under the rug so nobody knows, so that people won't be trying to go, well, wait a minute, I have a bad liver, or wait a minute, I have a brother that's missing an arm and we've never had birth defects in our family, or wait a minute, now I know why you don't have any legs and all that. And then for all the people to come together and sue the chemical company, I think that's what their issue is. I think they don't want everybody to know about the Agent Orange, because if everybody knew how awful it was, and that the government, they would have to pay for medical bills and all kinds of stuff, and they don't want to do that, so they try to hide it and pretend like it never happened.
It's just still on the cusp. It's just out on the edge. Nobody will take it and pull it in. Very famous actor in the United States, Tom Hanks, currently doing The 60s. It's a documentary series that's been showing on CNN. I waited on bated breath. You know, he's talking about the 60s and the Vietnam War and showing film and how it affected. I was waiting. Come on. Nothing. I went to a speech with journalists who were here during the war, who weren't in the military but were journalists, very famous journalists in Pittsburgh a couple months ago. I waited. Come on, something. Say something. Sorry. It makes me so angry. They just erase our history. They erase it. It's gone. It doesn't exist. They don't care. And that has been what we've heard our entire lives. You're controversialist. You just want controversy. You're just making stuff up. No, it's happened. They talked about everything. They talked about the strife. They talked about this and that and what it was like to be here and how the troops were and what it was like in the... Say something. You come here as a journalist and you stayed in Vietnam. You were able to see both sides of the story. And you've been back to Vietnam. And you talk about it. Say something. You know that the children here are still suffering. You know that the Vietnam vets are suffering. Say something. Nobody. You have people who are suffering, who have suffered their entire lives because of decisions people made in an office somewhere. They made the decision to spray this stuff. This is going to be a good idea. We're going to save people. People still today claim Agent Orange saved people. Okay, maybe it did. But those lives were worthwhile, and I don't diminish that at all. But there are millions of us that are suffering because of this chemical.
Seeing that these people have taken me in, like when we went to the Friendship Village and those Vietnamese veterans that came out, they were the NVA. They were the ones that were at war with my dad. And my dad probably shot at some of them, and some of them probably shot at my dad. And when I came face to face with those guys, that was a pretty intense moment because I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know if all of a sudden they were gonna have a flashback because they saw an American face or I just had no idea what to expect. But after he sat there and looked at me in my eyes for a good minute, and he came over there and he gave me a big hug, and he told me that Vietnam doesn't want war. They don't want to hate the American people, that they just want to live in peace from now on. And
now that I've come and I've been able to put faces, it's been a wonderful experience to get the second side of the story. Every conflict, every problem has two sides. I'd been raised with one side of the story, now I've gotten the second side of the story, and now I can take both those elements and put them together and formulate something to share with my children.
Just like my dad, I'm not going to lie about things when I get back to the United States and try to make it look nice or do anything. All my friends and family and stuff, I'm going to tell them how my trip was.
Once I came to Vietnam, I said, okay, this is more. This is more. This is bigger. This is bigger than Heather. Because a lot of my life was trying to deal with what happened to me. And when I came here and understood that the problem was way, way, way bigger than just me, or just a few of the kids that I had kind of connected with in the United States, I understood that I couldn't go back to just thinking of me and my story and my problems and those things. I knew I had to do more.
Troubled story, the tales full of sadness and woe, but I believe you smile again. You see, I know the pain you're just like you before, and I know where it's leading. Hold on,
there's nothing standing in your way. You can be strong.
So show the world what you can do.
Like you'll be outcast. Sometimes it's better to be alone than to be with the bad crowd. Preserve your mind and feed it. Nourish what it is you have inside. Use it in the right way.
Oh,
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, be satisfied. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, welcome to A to Z here on IB English Radio with me, Sister Zainab. And this idea of being satisfied is actually, it's really important. It's important in terms of, you know, our general attitude towards things. And it's important because most likely all of us, maybe on a daily basis, actually observe ourselves and also observe others, sort of expressing things where, you know, we people express discontent, dissatisfaction. And it's something that I think we all notice and we think, well, you know, why do we even open our mouths to say something like that? And before I go into some sort of more, maybe some of those bigger examples, I'll just talk about some of these little traits that many of us have. And that is, I'll just, for example, think about times in your family home when someone has cooked the food, so whether it's the, you know, the wife, the mother, or someone else. And maybe some people even say, some people even just pull a face. And let's just include the non-verbal communication here, because obviously usually we talk about the words that come out of our mouth, but I think it's about 90% of our communication with others is actually non-verbal anyway. So we have to be very careful not just to not say something derogatory about the meal that is put in front of us, but also not to, through our body language or the sort of face expression on our face, let on that maybe it's not that super tasty. Maybe we don't actually enjoy that food. So we have to be very careful with that. And one of the typical situations where we observe something like this, in a sense, is also in public. So whether it's whether we've visited other friends, but I think on the whole, we tend to be more polite, I think, when we go to friends, family, neighbors' houses. But what I have observed is that when we're, for example, in a cafe or restaurant, people might be more open to actually complaining. Welcome back to A to Z here on I'm English Radio with my sister Zainab, and I'm talking about this little trait that many of us have, that we just have a tendency to want to say something negative about things. So whether it's food we're given, whether it's something else, and there's another thing I hadn't mentioned. We also have to understand that when we're making a negative comment about something to another person, if we're sitting there and there's no one around us, we're sitting at a desk and we're just complaining about something, or other than Allah, no one hears us, inshallah. But as soon as we have people around us, if we're saying something negative towards another person so that another person can hear it, negative comments actually have more impact on us. So if we would then want to undo anything negative we've said, we actually have to make sort of twice as many comments, basically, that are positive. That's sort of a little bit the way human psychology works. But look, I also want to just give a lovely example from life of one of the famous martyrs of Holy Defense, the name of Ibrahim Hadi. So he didn't complain about things. So, for example, when it came to food, he was happy with whatever food was placed in front of him. And what he would do, see, he would not let on, for example, to his mother, that whether it was his favorite food or whatever, no one would have known what was going on inside him. He was just happy with anything. And for example, if he didn't like the food, he would then maybe just reach over to get some more bread instead and eat a bit less of the actual meal. So, you know, there are things we can do if we're ever faced with something we really just can't eat, you know, that we can get around it. But obviously, I just wanted to mention that we have to be very careful in these public settings, because I myself have observed that people sometimes have a tendency to be a bit negative or derogatory when they're sort of in that sort of setting. And they can sort of even be almost rude towards the wait staff. And obviously this is something we need to be aware of and sort of control If we're going to have a good akhlaq in our family settings with our friends, we need to extend the akhlaq in all public settings, inshallah. So I pray this is just a reminder for all of us, and I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A to Z here on Arab English Radio. And farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Thank you for joining us. The anticipated meeting between Trump and Netanyahu at the end of this month, the appointment of Lebanese civilian envoy to the mechanism committee, the repercussions of Netanyahu's request for a pardon, as well as the Iran file, were among the topics addressed in Hebrew media, and which we will discuss today in this episode with Dr. Mohammed Swaydan, academic and writer in international affairs. Hello and welcome to this episode, Dr. Mohammed. The anticipated meeting between Netanyahu and Trump on the 28th of December in Florida will discuss the existing disagreements between the two sides regarding the Gaza Strip, particularly the issue of Hamas's weapons and reconstruction. Do you agree with the report that there is a real divergence between the Americans and the Israelis, especially regarding Gaza?
Yes, there are divisions regarding how to achieve the end goal. They, of course, the U.S. and Israel agree on the end goal, that Hamas should be disarmed, that Gaza shouldn't have any weapons, that Israel's security is one of the main objectives in the region. So they do agree on the end goals, but they diverge on how to achieve the end goals. The Americans are think in a more strategic way than the Israelis. The Israelis are thinking from a way that they want to achieve their goals very fast, in a very fast way. That's why they differ.
But they're also playing around.
Of course they are playing around, but at the end of the road, the Israelis want to achieve the goals today. If you let the things for the Israelis alone, they have started a war in Gaza and in Lebanon from before this day. But because it's the Americans who are controlling, who are forcing, who are pressuring Israel, we are seeing more space for the political area. Israelis don't believe in the political solution, but the Americans, they work more on the political solution because they had a lot of experience in the region regarding how to use the military. They stayed in Iraq for 10 years. They stayed in Afghanistan for 20 years without achieving anything. They stayed in Libya for how many years without achieving anything. That's why, based on their experience, they believe in pressuring in politics to achieve the goals. That's what they are telling the Israelis, that you use the maximum capacity of your military. Now let's try achieving the goal in other ways. That's why they are buying time.
You highlighted these disagreements, but how do you think things will unfold, especially in Gaza?
Well, in Gaza, it's different than in Lebanon. I think in Gaza, Trump doesn't have a lot of ways to pressure Netanyahu there. At the end of the road, Netanyahu has...
You can pressure him more on the Lebanese front?
Exactly, because in Lebanon, there is American interests here. It's Lebanon isn't an Israeli file, it's an American file. That's why.
Okay, so in Gaza, it has more less control.
Yes,
over
in Gaza, the Americans has less control over Israel. That's why, well, we can say that it's most probably that the Israelis will return towards some kind of escalation inside of Gaza, even if the Americans don't want that escalation. But it's the Israelis that have the upper hand there. And that's how politics works. So I think that at the end of the road, Trump will try to get from Netanyahu something inside of Lebanon while giving him more freedom to act inside of Gaza. They will bargain between Lebanon and Gaza, giving Netanyahu
yes,
what they
the
want
Americans
in Gaza.
But the Americans are trying to establish a new base inside Gaza and trying to present themselves as a new player over there. Wouldn't that affect it?
Well, they have the mechanism inside of Lebanon, and this mechanism serves only Israeli interests. So it's not about what they have. This base inside of Gaza is just to control the Israeli actions. It's not to protect the Palestinians. So at a certain point, when the Israeli actions inside of Gaza abide with the American interests, mm-hmm. then this base
and
will
the report,
help them.
The report spoke about two public disagreements.
Yes, it's about reconstruction and disarming. It's not.
Okay.
It's not agreements about the
disagreements.
It's not disagreements about disarming
yes.
As an idea. It's disagreement about the time. Okay. Israelis want it faster than the Americans. The Americans believe that in politics we can achieve it, not in military. So the goal is one: disarm Hamas and even reconstruction. The goal is one: to reconstruct. But Israelis want it in a very slowly
the application
phase.
Is
exactly.
different. Okay, moving on to Lebanon, and after the appointment of a civilian envoy to the committee supervising the ceasefire alongside an Israeli envoy, discussions began circulating in the Israeli entity about the possibility of reaching an agreement with Lebanon. In recent statement, U.S. Envoy Tom Barak said that Israel will not be able to achieve or crush Hezbollah militarily. However, this seems to contradict what the commentator here in this report is saying, that it seems that there is some kind of an understanding that a permanent solution to Hezbollah is by launching a wider war against him initiated by Israel.
Yes, because this reflects the difference in opinions. For Israel, in Gaza and in Lebanon, the only solution is a military one. They believe in the superiority of Israel in the military field, and this superiority will lead to destroying the enemy. That's why the Israelis prefer the military solution inside of Lebanon, and they prefer it inside of Gaza. Mm-hmm. The Americans know. They think that in politics you can achieve more. They think that the war has reached the maximum capacity of it, and now it's time to pressure inside of politics. And the Americans believe that the Lebanese government today is a Western one. So why should we go towards the war inside of Lebanon?
And escalation as long as they are willing
exactly,
to negotiate.
Exactly, and they are willing to give us all what we want. So this is the divergence, it's how to achieve the end goal. And let us also shed light on one thing. Tom Barak used to say different things before. He used to say that we want to give the Lebanese army weapons in order to fight Hezbollah.
What changed now?
It's changed that he's not now in a responsible position regarding Lebanon, because the Lebanese fight today is with Morgan Ortegus and the Lebanese and the American ambassador inside of Lebanon. Mm-hmm. So once Tom Barak is out of the light, then he could say or he could express the truth. He could express what he believes in, that you cannot disarm Hezbollah militarily.
Okay, but then again, this is a disagreement between the two sides, as
yes,
you highlighted.
Yes, it's a disagreement.
Okay, so that means that a full-scale war against Lebanon is not on the table?
No, it is on the table. The timing is not. There is a difference on the timing. The Americans don't want a full-scale war. They are against it. Not all the Americans, but most of Trump's administration is against this war. And in Trump's administration, you have two wings. You mm-hmm. have the MAGA wing and the neocons. Mm-hmm. The MAGA are against it, and neocons are with it. But today, the MAGA has more influence in Trump's administration. That's why it's most probably the Americans don't want a full-scale war inside of Lebanon.
Okay.
For the Israelis, no, they want a full-scale war. But because Lebanon is or has a lot of American interest inside of the country, it's the Americans who have more control over Israel here, unlike in Gaza. That's why a full-scale war in the near future is not probable, but some kind of escalation is on the table.
Okay, but going back to what Tom Barak actually highlighted when he said that Israel won't be able to achieve its goals against Hezbollah militarily, because he's out of the picture, that does not mean that he represents the U.S. president's stance towards Lebanon. Is it a personal stance?
No, it's not a personal stance. It's a stance of...
representing the United States, representing...
No. It's representing a wing inside Trump's administration. Because Trump has
the same agenda or the same...
Yes, in Trump's administration...
The MAGA
you have,
wing?
Yes, you have a MAGA wing, which is Make America Great Again. Okay. This wing have been saying a lot in the last couple of months that it's for Trump, it should be either Make America Great Again or Make Israel Great Again. You have to decide if you are the president of the U.S. or if you are the president of Israel.
Speaking of.
These are parts of Trump's administration.
Yes.
And they are pressuring Trump now towards... following America's interests, not Israeli interests. And the American interest says that we should not participate and have more full-scale wars in the region.
There appears to be lack of understanding here when reference is made to Lebanese Christians, as they overwhelmingly support normalization or reaching an agreement with Israel.
Yes, of course, because, you know, he was expressing what is said in the media, mm-hmm. and he was saying that. Well, and he was said that the media is controlled by a minority of Christians, and it's important for people to know. It's not about religion here. There is only a minority, not a minority, there's part of the far-right Christians that are along with normalization with Israel.
Okay, so another failure in reading the composition of the Lebanese society.
Yeah, I think the Israelis, the Israeli government reads the Lebanese society very well, but there is a problem with the Israeli media, because the Israeli media takes its information from our country, from the Lebanese media. Most of the Lebanese media is for one side, not the other side. That's why you can see that the picture is not clear.
Okay. Meanwhile, one Israeli commentator said that Netanyahu's request for a pardon in relation to his trial may be linked to a regional major event that could take place. How do you interpret Netanyahu's pretext by requesting a pardon and saying or citing that there is a big event that will take place in the Middle East? Under that pretext, he's calling for a pardon.
Yeah, look, it's a continuation of a path. It's Netanyahu has been asking for a pardon for a while, and Trump also sent a letter asking for a pardon for Netanyahu.
And he said it in public in a press conference.
Exactly. So I think Netanyahu wants to benefit from what he achieved in the last 2 years.
But he linked it to a major event occurring in the Middle East. Why?
Well, of course, there are still many possibilities in the region, from Israel attacking Iran again, from Israel attacking Lebanon again, from Israel attacking Yemen. So there are many possibilities in the region. I think it's just a reason he is finding, but the main thing in his mind is that he wants to benefit from what he achieved in the last 2 years, mm-hmm. on the personal level.
For the elections?
For the elections and for the trials, and to get to just... Not lose in the trials. That's what he wants. And I think that the main thing in his mind, he wants to return Israel as Israel's king. So if you achieved all what you achieved in the region, but at the end of the day, you are guilty in the trial, then you will lose everything. So he wants to gain everything.
Will he get it?
I think to a certain level, yes, because I don't believe in democracy in democratic states. And I believe that at the end of the road, Israel.
The corruption fines against him are immense.
Yes.
He's been critically criticized by Haaretz and many newspapers.
As
many
long
Hebrew
as
newspapers.
Trump is in the White House, he won't be guilty and he won't go to prison, as long as Trump is in the White House.
Okay. Military correspondents in the Hebrew media pointed to Israeli concerns over the growing capabilities of Israeli's enemies and the need to intensify attacks against them. Do you think that the escalation of Israeli aggressions against Lebanon, Syria, Gaza will lead to a war, an all-out war against these countries eventually?
No, I don't think so. I think that no one has an interest in going towards war. Syria, of course, it won't ever just fire a bullet against Israel. because today the regime is serious, too aligned to the U.S. As for Iran, Yemen, Lebanon, maybe Iraq, so it's Gaza, it's all countries that may be attacked by Israel. At this point, I believe that the most probable scenario is going towards a low intensity conflict rather than going to a full scale war. But the main thing today we should concentrate on is what he said. It's very important. He said that after 2 years of putting more than $130 billion on the table, after 2 years of cooperating with the biggest technological companies around the world, after 2 years of the U.S. protecting Israel in the United Nations Security Council, after 2 years of having everything that Israel wants, today he is asking for the continuation of war. Why? Because the goal of destroying the enemy hasn't been achieved. And he said that
despite all that you highlighted.
Exactly. And he said that we are still at the starting point. So it's very important to say that despite all of everything that Israel has been paying for, has been getting the support to, they believe that they are still at the starting point, and this starting point is shrinking. So that's very important for people to understand that the
goal has not been achieved.
Number one, the goal has not been achieved.
Yes.
Number two, the conflict is too complex to analyze just based on who won and who lost. Mm-hmm. It's too complex. It's a starting point. It's everyone has now,
yes,
and what are the possible scenarios.
Okay, and now to Iran, where information leaked by the Hebrew media is abundant about widespread espionage cases by Israelis for the benefit of Iran, an issue which was addressed by a former Shin Bet official. How does this issue impact Israeli calculations towards Iran?
First of all, the ironic thing is that he was criticizing Iran trying to work with Israeli citizens because they are innocent people outside of the conflict. And it is as if Israel doesn't try to cooperate with any citizen in all the region, whether he is young or he is not. And it is as if Israel also cares about citizens, about not putting them inside of conflict. Well, there are more than 100,000 people in Gaza that died, who were innocent, thousands of people in Lebanon. So I think this is part of the narrative.
Okay, if Israel at one point is thinking about launching a war against Iran, these kind of cases, do they make them think twice, the Israelis?
Of course.
If they're trying to initiate a war against it with this amount of espionage.
Of course. The more Iran uses intelligence operations,
okay,
the more this deters Israel, because it gives it the idea that we don't know what Iran knows about us. And that's very important to increase the deterrence between Israel and Iran. So yes, the more the Iranians try to work on Israel from the intelligence perspective, try to cooperate with people inside of Israel, try to use information inside of Israel, and to get information from there, this will deter Israel more. But at a certain
point, why? Because they would feel that the Iranians are in more control?
They would feel that there is a certain cost that they don't know what it is. They have no idea what Iran has information about us. But at the same
point... So the uncertainty.
The uncertainty, yes. This increases the possibility of deterrence. But at the same time, we should keep in mind that the Israelis, at a certain point, think from an ideological point of view, not from a realistic one. So at a certain point, Israelis may go towards some kind of operation inside of Iran because they have no ability to stop such intelligence operations. So they may think that to stop intelligence operations, to stop Iranians from cooperating with Israelis.
And one of the traits of dominance is knowing your enemy
exactly
better. Okay, but here, if this would happen, what you're saying, would Americans support an all-out war against Iran?
As I said before, I don't think that an all-out war is an interest, nor to the U.S., nor to any country in the region. Only Israel wants it. But I think that an all-out war between Israel and Iran is almost impossible. They could return to something similar to the 12-day war. And this is what Israel is pushing for. And at the end of the road, if Israel initiated a war when the U.S. wasn't approving it, Trump will assist Israel. There is a law, there is a rule inside of the U.S. You can never leave Israel to its enemies.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you don't agree with the decision of the war, you have to support it.
Okay.
However, Israeli social media commentators also reflected on these espionage cases and on the wider issues of war with Iran.
Ilana Sayuri. Iranian intelligence recruits Israelis through emails containing thanks to collaborators and requests for their identity and their Telegram account number to communicate with them. Shomrim. The Iranians know who their spies are. They are idiots seeking easy money. The Shin Bet met with mayors and school principals in central Israel to raise awareness of this issue. Ariel Hai. Some in Israel are disconnected from reality. What does it mean to talk about invading a country as large as Iran? As stated by a former chief of staff, what a fool.
Dr. Mohammed Sweden, academic and writer in international affairs, thank you very much for joining us in today's episode.
A warm greetings once again to all our dear listeners around the world. You're listening to Iran Radio. Iran Radio is here and you are listening to some interesting facts about Islam. Muslims believe they are members of a worldwide Muslim community known as the Ummah, united by a religious bond that transcends tribal, ethnic, and national identities. The first mosque built in the U.S. was the Mother Mosque of America, which was built in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, in 1934. It is still used for worship today. Let's see what this next hour holds. Coming right up, it's news this hour. Then we have Minbar. After that, tune in for another special session of radio productions. And closing the hours, don't miss Leader's Speech. Thanks for joining us. Up next, news this hour.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour's top headlines. Iran calls on world countries to take action on Washington's anti-Venezuela measures, warning that any inaction will form a basis for widespread violations of international law. A pro-Palestinian hacking group publishes the names and photos of 11 Israelis who have been described as the architects of the regime's Iron Dome missile system. And finally, the Russian military launches a massive drone and missile strike on Ukraine, causing widespread blackouts. Moscow says it's retaliation of Ukrainian attacks inside Russia. Welcome, everyone. New World News. Let's go ahead and get started with the stories that matter. Well, Iran says U.S. military threats against Venezuela are a dangerous escalation of unilateral coercion that threatens the international system.
Venezuela is a member of the non-aligned movement and a member of the UN Charter.